From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! The CIA's torture teachers, psychologists helping the CIA exploit a secret military program to develop brutal interrogation tactics. Salon.com's Mark Benjamin says it was likely with the approval of the Bush White House. This weekend, torture survivors held a vigil at the White House to demand an end to U.S.-supported torture. We'll speak with torture survivor Sister Deanna Ortiz, then Salt Lake City Mayor Rocky Anderson. He joins us in the studio. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. It's been another bloody weekend for U.S. troops in Iraq. At least 12 soldiers died on Saturday, bringing the week's death toll to at least 31. In the city of Mosul, an Iraqi journalist was killed on Sunday as the country marked Iraqi Journalist Day, a day set aside to acknowledge the media workers killed during the war. Zina Shakir Mahmoud was shot to death on her way from home from work. She was a Sunni Arab, but wrote about women's affairs for a Kurdish newspaper. Earlier today, another Iraqi journalist, Rahim al-Maliki, died in suicide bombing that killed 12 people. Al-Maliki was an anchor on Iraqiya state television. According to Reporters Without Borders, 184 journalists and media assistants have been killed since the U.S. invasion. In other Iraq news, the Iraqi High Tribunal has sentenced Ali Hassan al-Majid and two others to death. They were convicted of genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes for ordering the use of chemical weapons against Kurds during the Iran-Iraq War. Al-Majid, who is nicknamed Chemical Ali, was a cousin of former President Saddam Hussein. In Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai's government has accused U.S. and NATO forces of killing more than 90 civilians over the past 10 days in a series of airstrikes and artillery fire. Meanwhile, a new survey by the Associated Press has determined more civilians have been killed this year in attacks by the U.S.-led coalition and NATO forces than by militants linked to the Taliban. Karzai accused foreign troops of using extreme and disproportionate force. He warned the fight against the Taliban could fail unless foreign forces show more restraint. Karzai said, quote, innocent people are becoming victims of reckless operations. Meanwhile, 10 civilians were killed in Pakistan after NATO forces stationed in Afghanistan fired mortars along the border. In other news from Pakistan, new evidence has emerged suggesting Pakistan is planning to expand its nuclear weapons arsenal. A leading Washington think tank says satellite photos show Pakistan is close to completing a third previously unknown plutonium production reactor. David Albright of the Institute for Science and International Security said the plant would give Pakistan the ability to build a new generation of lighter, more powerful weapons that can more easily be launched via missiles. Pakistan is believed to already have 50 nuclear weapons. The disclosure comes at a tumultuous time in Pakistan. Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid recently wrote, growing opposition to Pakistan's military dictator, General Pervez Musharraf, could lead to a civil war or the unraveling of the country. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas are meeting today for a summit in Egypt, one day after Israel agreed to transfer hundreds of millions of dollars to Abbas's emergency government in the West Bank. Israeli government spokesperson Mary Eisen said Israel is prepared to take other steps to back Abbas. Meanwhile, Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh addressed Palestinians on Sunday. Earlier this month, Haniyeh lost his post as Palestinian prime minister after Abbas dissolved the democratically elected Hamas-led government. Haniyeh accused the United States of providing Abbas's Fatah forces with money and arms in order to oust Hamas. In other news from the region, the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem is calling on Hamas to secure the release of Gilad Shalit, the Israeli soldier who was captured a year ago today. Hamas officials have said Shalit is alive and being held in proper conditions, but these claims have never been verified. The International Committee of the Red Cross has been barred from visiting him. Hamas has repeatedly demanded Israel release some of the over 10,000 Palestinian prisoners being held in Israel. Meanwhile, a new video has been broadcast of kidnapped BBC correspondent Alan Johnston. He's shown wearing what he says is an explosive vest. Johnston was abducted March 12th in Gaza. In the tape, Johnston says his captors, they will detonate the vest if force is used to try to free him. Sunday was a particularly bloody day in Lebanon. Six United Nations peacekeepers died in a car bombing just north of the Israeli border. Three Colombian and two Spanish peacekeepers were among the dead. It's not known who carried out the attack. Meanwhile, 11 people died after Lebanese troops raided a house in the northern city of Tripoli. The Lebanese army said foreign militants were using the house as a hideout. More than a dozen countries are meeting in France today to discuss how to stop the violence in Sudan's Darfur region, where over 200,000 people have died. Ahead of the conference, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said the international community has failed the people of Darfur. Meanwhile, the United Nations' top environmental official has warned environmental degradation of land and resources in Darfur will make it impossible for many of the more than 2 million people uprooted by the conflict to return home. Achim Steiner said desertification, soil erosion, and shrinking rainfall over past decades meant that much of Darfur could not support its previous human and livestock population. In northern Darfur, the past 80 years have seen a one-third drop in average rainfall, a situation expected to worsen as a result of ongoing climate change. On Capitol Hill, the former head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Christine Todd Whitman, will testify today about how the EPA handled air quality issues at Ground Zero following the September 11th attacks. In the days after the Twin Towers collapsed, Whitman assured New York City residents the air was safe to breathe. Over the weekend, Whitman claimed that former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani blocked her efforts to force workers at the World Trade Center to wear respirators. In military news, the number of African Americans joining the armed forces has declined by 38%. Since 2001. 6 years ago, the military had over 51,000 new black recruits. Last year, the number plunged to just 32,000. Meanwhile, ABC News is reporting the U.S. Army has been forced to pull a television recruitment ad aimed at African-American recruits. The ad had to be pulled because the Army can't actually train recruits to become pharmacists. David Work, the former president of the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy, accused the Army of purposely lying in an attempt to recruit teenagers. A new version of the ad replaces the word pharmacist with healthcare technician. The commercial was produced by the advertising agency Casanova Pendrell. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has voted to force lawmakers to raise fuel efficiency standards for the first time in more than 20 years. The bill calls for all new cars, trucks, and SUVs to get an average of 35 miles per gallon by the year 2020. Meanwhile, Republican senators stripped sections of the bill that would have required oil and gas companies to spend some of their profits to help research renewable energy sources. Republicans also blocked a proposal to require utility companies to produce 15% of their electricity with renewable fuels by 2020. The Democratic-controlled House has passed a series of funding bills dealing with Venezuela, Cuba, and Saudi Arabia. The House voted to spend $10 million to bolster Voice of America broadcast to Venezuela and Latin America. Venezuela responded by accusing the U.S. of escalating its media campaign against the Chavez government. The Democratic-controlled House also agreed to give President Bush $46 million to back Cuban dissidents in Cuba. This marks a five-fold jump over last year's budget. A recent congressional study found previous allocations to Cuban dissidents had been spent on such items as Godiva chocolates and cashmere sweaters. The House also voted Friday to prohibit any foreign aid to Saudi Arabia, one of the Bush administration's closest allies in the Middle East. The vote is largely symbolic since the U.S. sends little aid to the Saudis. In other news from Capitol Hill, an attempt in the House to close the U.S. Military Training Center, once known as the School of the Americas, has failed. 42 Democrats joined with Republicans to continue funding the Defense Institute for Hemispheric Security Cooperation. Human rights groups have urged Congress to close the school, which has long been linked to human rights atrocities committed in Latin America. In political news, Vice President Cheney's daughter Elizabeth has become an advisor to likely Republican presidential candidate Fred Thompson. Up until recently, Elizabeth Cheney was a top official in the State Department's Near East and South Asia Department. Thousands of online radio stations are planning to participate in a National Day of Silence Tuesday to protest new royalty rate increases that threaten the future of many internet radio stations. As part of the protests, many radio stations, including Pacifica Radio's KPFA, plan to shut off their internet streams for the day. In March, the Copyright Royalty Board ordered online radio stations, including non-commercial stations, to pay drastically increased royalty rates for every song. The new rates go into effect July 15th. Some stations will see their rates increase by 1,200%. Last week, members of the Save Net Radio Coalition urged Congress to pay the Internet Radio Quality Act to pass that, which would vacate the rate increase and set the royalty rate at the same level paid by satellite radio services. In New York, a prominent civil rights attorney was arrested and beaten by police officers in Brooklyn after he tried to stop the police from hitting a handcuffed teenager. The attorney, Michael Warren, said a police officer punched him in the head and hit his wife in the jaw. Several city officials have urged the police department to drop charges against Warren and his wife. Warren's been a leading critic of police abuse in New York City. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The CIA's torture teachers. Psychologists helping the CIA exploit a secret military program to develop brutal interrogation tactics. That's the beginning of a new article by Salon.com's Mark Benjamin. Last month, the Pentagon Inspector General declassified a report that provided concrete evidence that methods developed by the U.S. military for withstanding torture are being used to develop interrogation techniques against prisoners. Investigative journalist Mark Benjamin uncovers a new twist to the story, the CIA's use of similar tactics as the military interrogators. He also points to the high-level coordination between the CIA and the U.S. military in developing the interrogation methods. Benjamin also reveals that two psychologists who worked as contractors for the CIA since 9/11 are at the center of the program. Both men are currently under investigation. Mark Benjamin is a national correspondent for Salon.com. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mark.
Thank you so much for having me.
Explain what you have discovered.
Well, what we've learned is that there's a special school, a secretive school called Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape, and that's where we train elite troops to resist if captured by an enemy who ignores the Geneva Conventions, things like waterboarding, stress positions, sexual humiliation, isolation, that sort of thing. And reporters, including myself, have been working for years now to try to show that it looks like the Pentagon sort of reverse engineered those tactics to interrogate real prisoners. The Pentagon said no, no, no until last month. You mentioned an Inspector General report that came out and said, well, yes, in fact, the Pentagon did do that. What we've learned now is that it appears that the CIA, working very closely with the Pentagon, did the same thing very early in the war on terror, relying on psychologists very close to this program. And because both agencies turned to this program, they called the SEER program, early in the war on terror, it suggests very high-level coordination in the Bush administration.
Explain just what the SEER program is.
The SEER program is a Cold War-era program where we literally set up mock, you know, prisons at places like Fort Bragg, North Carolina, which is where we have sort of the flagship program, where elite soldiers, for example, special forces soldiers, are subject to brutal mock interrogations. As I mentioned, waterboarding is just one of the things that they face. Isolation in very, very small pens, hooding, that kind of thing, stress positions. And it is intended to teach those soldiers to resist those illegal tactics if they are captured. Now, that raises an obvious problem. If you're going to take that training, which is designed to get people to resist illegal interrogations, and flip it around to interrogation tactics, which is now what we're learning the Pentagon and the CIA both did, you're very likely, obviously, to come up with tactics that are violations of the Geneva Conventions. That's a problem for the Bush administration, which has been saying that their tactics are safe, effective, and legal. SEER training is not designed to be safe, effective, or legal.
You talk about two CIA-employed psychologists. who are under investigation right now. Explain who they are.
The two psychologists are named James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, and these are psychologists who have been affiliated with this training program, again, called the SEER program, for years. What we have learned is that the Senate Armed Services Committee, this is a committee run by Carl Levin, a Democrat from Michigan, is now looking into the activities of these two psychologists in particular. What our sources on Capitol Hill and, in fact, some of Mitchell and Jessen's own colleagues say is that these guys, these psychologists, who are affiliated with the military's SEER training, were then employed by the CIA as contractors to do the same thing that the military was doing, which was to flip these tactics around and use them on real terrorists. And in fact, Jane Mayer from The New Yorker, who's done some wonderful reporting also on this issue, put one of these guys, James Mitchell, in the room with a high-level CIA detainee in early 2002. And according to Mayer, he was urging some very rough stuff.
Who's investigating them?
The Senate Armed Services Committee is looking into these guys, and in fact, based on Carl Levin's request, the Department of Defense has ordered anybody associated with the Department of Defense, including, you know, in a memo to the chairman, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and others, that any document that has the name of these two guys, Bruce Jessen or James Mitchell, has to be preserved, and nobody can destroy documents associated with those two guys because they're part of this Senate investigation.
Can you talk about the letter that psychologists have written to the American Psychological Association and the controversy that's brewing within this organization of close to 150,000 psychologists?
There's a major rift on the American Psychological Association, the Professional Association for Psychologists. In 2005, the American Psychological Association came up with ethics guidelines that essentially say that a psychologist can help participate in a military interrogation. This is a big deal because the American Psychiatric Association for Psychiatrists said, no, we won't have any part of it. It turns out that 6 of the 10 individuals, psychologists, who helped draft those ethics guidelines for the American Psychological Association were affiliated with the military. And in fact, several of them were affiliated with this SEER school. This issue has been really tearing apart the American Psychological Association for years now, and there is an expanding group of psychologists who are very, very concerned that the American Psychological Association's own ethical guidelines are allowing psychologists like these guys, Bruce Jessen and James Mitchell, to reverse engineer training tactics into really brutal interrogation techniques. And there's a bunch of letter writing back and forth, frankly, to the head of the president of the American Psychological Association, objecting to these ethic guidelines and perhaps the use of these tactics.
You write about the dozens of psychologists who made public a joint letter to the American Psychological Association President Sharon Brem, fingering another CIA-employed psychologist. He was one of the 10 on that committee in 2005 that was convened to look at psychologists' involvement in these interrogations. Explain who he is.
That's a guy whose last name is Shumate. He's a psychologist with a counterterrorism center at the CIA. This is the center that reported at the time of 9/11 was a guy named Kofor Black was in charge of that unit. You may recall Kofor Black is very well known for going up to Congress early in the war on terror and saying, you know, there's a before after 9/11 and there's an after 9/11. After 9/11, the gloves come off. What the psychologists are concerned about is that their fellow psychologists who are associated with that center, the Counterterrorism Center, seem to be also, you know, crucial in reverse engineering these tactics, these training tactics into brutal interrogation techniques, or at least that's the concern among these psychologists. And what they're doing is alerting their organization that there could be a real problem here.
Of course, Kofor Black now involved with Blackwater, the private security company based in North Carolina and an offshoot of that around intelligence. Now, R. Scott Shumate was one of the 10 people involved in this PENS task force, this advisory task force that ultimately advised that the psychologists could continue in these military interrogations, despite the fact that 3 of the members, we had 2 of them on Democracy Now!, have expressed great concern about them. One of these members handing over all of her notes leading up to the meeting and afterwards, the email listservs over to the Senate Armed Services Committee as they conduct their investigation.
That's right. And some of the psychologists, as you mentioned, these civilian psychologists sort of feel like they were railroaded or misled, or, you know, in other words, the military folks who were on that panel, which came up with these ethics guidelines, sort of ran the show. I think that's sort of what you're referring to there. And yes, there's very serious concern about these psychologists. Their own fellow professionals may have played a vital role in flipping these techniques around, both at the Pentagon, and now we've learned also at the CIA. Into some really brutal interrogation techniques.
Can you talk about the issue of jointness, Mark Benjamin?
Yeah, jointness is a term, if you talk to people in the military, it's a term that refers to a high-level decision made by some, you know, for example, made at the White House for the CIA and the military to work hand-in-hand on a high-level project. In this case, it would be interrogations. What happened in this particular case is we have jointness with respect to interrogations. Very early in the war on terror, the CIA and the Pentagon worked very closely together to develop these interrogation techniques based on this sort of brutal training of our own troops. As again, it's referred to as jointness. So what you may have, what you'll have, that will explain a lot of things. It would explain why in interrogation rooms you may have a bunch of CIA people, and then you may have, you know, an elite Special Forces soldier or a Delta Force soldier participating in these interrogations. So what you've got is our most elite troops working very, very closely with the CIA on some very tough interrogations.
The issue of isolation and one of these two psychologists' key role in that.
Yeah, one of the psychologists is a guy named Bruce Jessen, who is apparently an expert on isolation. The reason why that's interesting is last month the Council of Europe, a human rights agency, came out with a new report sort of explaining what was happening to these CIA detainees when they were in these, you know, black sites, as what the president calls them, or what they've been called. And one of the things that happens with these folks is they're put into a room with no sound, a low white light, air coming in through a hole in the ceiling, and virtually no interaction with other human beings for 120 days. The research seems to show that if that happens, you start to lose your sense of identity, you hallucinate, you hear things, you see things that don't exist, and you break down psychologically. It is a form of abuse that leaves no marks. And I think the concern is that because the CIA apparently employed those tactics, that some of these psychologists may have played a role in helping the CIA and the military learn how to do that.
When we had the psychologists on, two of the 10 people who ran this task force for the American Psychological Association, nine of them voting members, six of them military, Nina Thomas, psychologist based in New York, who is a part of that, said though she knew about the military connection, she didn't realize how involved some of the members were in this presidential task force who was making their recommendation to the APA, how involved they were in the SEER program and in the interrogations. Among those she talked about was Colonel Morgan Banks.
That's right. Morgan Banks is a guy who's affiliated with the Special Operations Command Psychological Directorate. So these are the top psychologists associated with the Special Operations units in the military. What we learned last month, the Department of Defense Inspector General declassified a report that showed that department, the Special Operations Command Psychological Applications Directorate, early in the war came up with a plan specifically to do this. In other words, when I say this, I mean take these training tactics, these brutal mock interrogations, and flip them around into real interrogation techniques. Because this guy Morgan Banks was in charge of that portion of special operations, it certainly seems to strongly suggest, it doesn't say Morgan Banks by name, but it says his organization did this. So if you've got a guy who is involved, who is part of the original planning to turn these techniques into real interrogation tactics, and then he's sitting on a task force at the American Psychological Association drawing up ethics guidelines that say that can be done, I think that's raising some real alarm bells among psychologists.
Well, we'll certainly continue to follow this issue. The APA meeting, the American Psychological Association meeting, annual conference will be taking place in San Francisco in mid-August. I know that there are many who are withholding their dues, many psychologists. Some have quit over this. We'll continue to follow this as some new exposés are expected to come out in the next few weeks. And I thank you, Mark Benjamin, for joining us. Mark Benjamin, national correspondent at Salon.com. Mark, finally, on Friday, I went over to Yeshiva University here in New York, which had a 50th anniversary conference called War, Torture, and Terror, the role of psychology. Michael Gelis spoke. He was one of those members on that president on that task force at the APA. He defended the position of the psychologist's involvement in military interrogations. Afterwards, a number of psychologists seriously questioned him from the audience.
Yes, and the argument from people like Gelis, who did sit on this panel, is that having a psychologist, you know, in the room or near the room when there's an interrogation going on, it allows that psychologist to be sort of like a safety officer. In other words, let's at least have psychologists nearby so they can set some limits. The flip side of that, of course, is that psychologists are, as medical professionals, they know how to push people's buttons. And there are interrogation transcripts, including this guy, the 20th hijacker Catani, that show psychologists at Guantanamo telling interrogators, this is how you crank up the pressure. Not acting as safety officers during interrogations, but is telling interrogators essentially how to be more coercive. And that's at the crux of the matter.
Mark Benjamin of Salon.com. We will link to his piece at democracynow.org, as well as our previous discussion with the psychologists involved with this advisory group that recommended that psychologists can continue with these military interrogations. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Torture survivors from around the world gathered Saturday in front of the White House to mark the 10th anniversary of the UN Day in support of torture victims and survivors. The survivors were all members of the Torture Abolition and Survivors Support Coalition, or TASC, the only organization in the United States made up of survivors of torture. TASC chose to do this year's vigil at the White House to officially launch its campaign to repeal the Military Commissions Act, which survivors of torture have renamed the torture law. Sister Diana Ortiz is the founder of TASC. In 1989, she was abducted by Guatemalan security forces while working as a missionary among indigenous people in Guatemala. She was taken to a secret prison in the capital center and brutally tortured. She was burned with cigarettes over 100 times. She was raped. She was beaten. And she was forced to torture and kill a woman who was already near death. Sister Ortiz was the main organizer of this weekend's 24-hour vigil in front of the White House. She joins us now from Washington, D.C. Sister Diana Ortiz, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you so much for joining us. I know that your voice is very, very sore, so we'll just listen carefully as you whisper. Describe why you went to the White House on Saturday.
Torture survivors from TASC International have declared June as Torture Awareness Month. And we believe that it's very important to raise awareness about the plight of torture in our world today. There are more than 150 governments engaged in torture today, including the United States government. We believe that the United States government and the American people need to know about the seriousness of this horrible crime against humanity. We decided that we would hold our 24-hour vigil on Saturday to draw more attention to the public. We are trying to do whatever we can to break the silence against torture.
I wanted to read from today's Washington Post. The vice president's office played a central role in shattering limits on coercion in U.S. custody, commissioning and defending legal opinions that the Bush administration has since portrayed as the initiatives months later of lower-ranking officials. Cheney and his allies, according to more than two dozen current and former officials, pioneered a novel distinction between forbidden torture and permitted use of cruel, inhuman, or degrading methods of questioning. They did not originate every idea to rewrite or reinterpret the law, but fresh accounts from participants show that they translated muscular theories from John Yoo and others into the operational language of government. A backlash beginning in 2004 after reports of abuse leaked out of Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison and Guantanamo Bay brought what appeared to be sharp reversals in courts and Congress for both Cheney's claims of executive supremacy and his unyielding defense of what he called robust interrogation. Your response, Sister Deanna Ortiz. Deanna. Deanna, are you still with us in Washington? Can you hear us, Deanna? We may have lost Sister Deanna Ortiz. I'll read a little more from the Washington Post piece. This is a piece that's an ongoing series on the vice president, on Vice President Dick Cheney. And it says, a more careful look at the results suggests that Cheney won far more than he lost. Many of the harsh measures he championed and some of the broadest principles undergirding them have survived intact but out of public view. No longer was the vice president focused on procedural rights such as access to lawyers and courts. The subject now was more elemental. How much suffering could U.S. personnel inflict on an enemy to make him talk? Cheney's lawyer, David Addington, feared future prosecutors with motives difficult to predict might bring criminal charges against interrogators or Bush administration officials. What about, Sister Deanna Ortiz, the White House's role? Today's Washington Post piece is about the centrality of the vice president's office in this issue of torture and defining torture.
Unfortunately, I have not read the article, but what I'm hearing right now is makes me so angry that our government is allowing the president and the vice president and other important government officials to be engaged in torture. And I'm outraged, as with other survivors, that members of Congress, our leaders, are just standing by and letting this crime be.
I know, Sister Deanna Ortiz, this is incredibly difficult for you, that you live with this every day. Not only that you went through what you went through in Guatemala, but that you have committed your life to working with other torture survivors from around the country and the world. I'm wondering how you respond to the administration's argument that you are preventing greater crimes, that the administration is preventing greater crimes by being involved in these interrogations because they're trying to get information out of terrorists that could prevent a greater crime. Your response?
Torturing another person does not result in getting information.
Can you talk, Deanna, about who came to the White House? Who are the other people from around the world who joined you?
torture survivors from Nigeria, Peru, Colombia, Iran, Iraq, the Philippines. I apologize. This is just very difficult.
And I know that it was a 24-hour vigil in front of the White House, and it's a series of days that you'll be involved with this, culminating in tomorrow, which is the 10th anniversary of the United Nations. Explain what the torture convention is passed by the UN General Assembly, if you can. Deanna, can you hear me? We seem to have lost her again. Sister Deanna Ortiz, I want to thank you for being with us. I know that this is very hard for you. Of course, we will continue to follow this issue. There are actions planned in Washington and New York and other places around the issue of torture. Thank you so much for being here. Sister Deanna Ortiz, a Catholic nun, who was abducted and tortured by Guatemalan security forces, working as a missionary in Guatemala. She is founder of the Torture Abolition and Survivor Support Coalition. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we return from break, we'll be joined by Rocky Anderson, the mayor of Salt Lake City. Stay with us. John Fahey here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on low-power FM and college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish. Over 150 radio stations around the world are taking them. You can get your radio station to take them as well. I'm Amy Goodman. Rocky Anderson, the mayor of Salt Lake City, is one of the most outspoken critics of the Bush administration and the Iraq War. Earlier this year, he called for the impeachment of President Bush, calling him a war criminal who's committed high crimes and misdemeanors. Rocky Anderson is also well-regarded for his local politics. Last year, The Nation magazine praised him for instituting, quote, some of the most creative, thoughtful, and radical urban policies anywhere in America. Today, Rocky Anderson is in New York to participate in an evening event calling for the impeachment of President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. He'll be speaking at the New York Society for Ethical Culture. Mayor Anderson joins us now. Welcome to Democracy.
Real pleasure
now.
To see you, Amy. Thank you.
Impeachment is off the table, though, in Washington, D.C. Your party, the Democratic Party, the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, has said no, that that's not the direction they're going to go. One of the chief proponents of it, John Conyers, head of the House Judiciary Committee, has backed off of that demand. Yet you continue.
Well, I've taken my proud Democrat coffee mug out of my shelf and put it into storage for a while.
Are you going to do like Michael Bloomberg has done? Are you going to leave your party?
I'm not proud of my party. I expect that a George Bush and Cheney will come along and try to abuse their power and usurp and undermine the balance of power, disregard the rule of law. And I expect sometimes that the Republican Party is going to support them in that, as we saw during the regime of Richard Nixon. What I don't expect is that we not have an opposition party all these years, that we not have a party who will stand up against the fiscal recklessness, about the lies that have driven us into this disastrous war of aggression. And I am ashamed of the Democratic Party. There have been a few heroes, a few people that have stood up, but the party as a whole, I think, has been a dismal failure these last several years in standing up to this insanity.
Let's go back to last October. The House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader in the then Republican-controlled Congress, was asked by 60 Minutes, Leslie Stahl, whether the Democrats would pursue the impeachment of President Bush if Democrats gain control of the House.
No, impeachment is off the table.
And that's a pledge.
Well, it's a pledge. It's a pledge. Of course it is. It is a waste of time.
We can't hear. That was Nancy Pelosi.
It seems very odd to me that any Democrat would say that a constitutional remedy, a remedy the founders felt very strongly about when a president, through his or her wrongdoing, is doing damage to our country, that remedy would ever be off the table. There can only be one reason for it, and that's the Democrats want to politically cash in on this disastrous administration in the 2008 elections. And I think that's wrong. I think that when we have a president who has blatantly violated our own Constitution, our own treaty obligations, our own statutory law, abused his powers in remarkable ways, undermined the balance of power, exerted a unitary executive power unknown to this country and to our democracy, and at the same time betrayed his trust with our Congress, with the American people, by his deceit in leading us into this war, and through his utter incompetency. If impeachment were ever called for, this is certainly the time, and this is exactly what the founders had in mind.
The Democratic leadership argues that it would distract from other things that need to get passed.
We need some people in Congress who can multitask. It's been done before. The Republicans were able to do it in a case against President Clinton where there was no harm to the country alleged. They were talking about a lie in a private lawsuit having to do with a private affair, not an impeachable offense. Never was that kind of thing contemplated by the founders. But here we have an instance where our country is suffering in so many ways across the board. Our young men and women are being killed, hundreds of thousands in another country that pose no danger to us are being killed. All the wounded, the financial implications that will be felt for generations, and all of us being lied to get to this point. Impeachment, although I understand people's reticence about it, if you take a step back and look at all that's happened, impeachment has never been more justified. And my point is, let us make that statement to the rest of the world that this is not the American values. This is not who we are as the American people. We don't believe in kidnapping, disappearing, torturing people as a matter of official policy, and it's absolutely unprecedented in our nation's history. that we're engaging in those sorts of things. The warrantless wiretapping of people's conversations, of their emails, United States citizens, arresting, basically kidnapping American citizens and denying them any due process, the right to a lawyer, right to a trial, the right to habeas corpus. We have become, not becoming, but we have become as a nation under the Bush administration, the sort of totalitarian country like those from whom we have always been proud to distinguish ourselves. We've always looked at other nations and said, they're the ones that kidnap, disappear, and torture their people, and even kill them when they're perceived to be on the other side. Now that's exactly what this president is doing in our nation's name. We need to stand up as a people, let the world know, let posterity know, that's not who Americans are. This doesn't reflect our values.
Mayor Anderson, how would you end this war?
I would end this war by going to the United Nations and saying there need to be peacekeeping troops. We need to work with the entire region. We need to have discussions with neighboring countries, countries that this administration has refused to deal with, like Iran, like Syria. But we need to pull our troops out, because every day American troops have a presence there, we're seen as the occupying force. And as long as we're seen as the occupying force, there will be more terrorists. We're feeding right into bin Laden's plan. We're feeding right into his perception of who the United States is, this imperialist country. This war would never have begun. The attacks on 9/11 would never have happened. Osama bin Laden's declaration of war against the United States would never have happened had we not maintained permanent bases in Saudi Arabia, contrary to Dick Cheney's promises when he was Secretary of Defense that after the first Gulf War, we would remove those bases. Osama bin Laden saw those bases as basically a Christian and Jewish occupying of the Muslim holy lands. And now what have we done? We've invaded and occupied another Muslim country that posed no danger whatsoever to the United States. And let the Muslim world know that we are asserting that kind of control, that we're going to tell them what kind of government they have, that we're going to tell their military what to do. Every single day that happens with our troops, we're making the situation worse, and it is so far worse off for the Iraqi people.
What is your feeling in Utah, your constituents, your community, Salt Lake City? You have many young men and women who've been sent to Iraq. How do they respond to you?
It's a mixed bag. We've had some huge demonstrations there the last two times President Bush has come to town. We've held demonstrations. I spoke at both of those. And there's a lot of controversy around it, but I can tell you after the last time he came, although there were those who thought that just because he's the president, I should lay out the welcoming mat and shut up, there was far less on the merits being said in support of the war. And as I said at the time, you know, I'm speaking up, and if anybody wants to stand up and support the kidnapping, disappearing, and torture of human beings, if anybody wants to stand up and justify the warrantless wiretapping of Americans, if somebody wants to stand up and defend this nation being deceived into this war of aggression against a country that posed no danger to us, I'm happy to hear that from you. I think you should stand up and support the president. We never heard that. All we heard was a sort of mindless, well, he's the president and we need to get behind him and support him. Or this notion that you can't support the troops if you're not supporting the war at the same time. I can tell you more and more, and I'm even hearing it not just from families of American servicemen and women in active duty. I'm hearing it from people in the active duty right now. We've got to end this war. We're not accomplishing anything. We're working against our own interests. And I even have good longtime Republicans coming up and mostly whispering. They're not out there in the streets yelling, although some of them do come to the demonstrations now. They're telling me, you're absolutely right. This president is ruining this country. He needs to go.
When I came out to Salt Lake City, I interviewed you and also Sergeant Marshall Thompson, who was the officer in Iraq. He actually was the editor of the Anaconda Times. He was a military journalist and said he had interviewed many, many soldiers, many of them opposed to war. This was in Iraq. And when he came home to Utah, the reddest state in the nation, he and his wife walked across the state protesting the war and were joined by many people actually across the political spectrum. His website was A Soldier's Peace. And he said in that way he would participate. His father, the ex-mayor of Logan, Utah. Mitt Romney, can you talk about this adopted son of Utah who also has a vacation home there? He just did a campaign swing through Utah. He has a home in Utah, also in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, claimed residency in Utah from 1999 to 2002 during his time as president of the Salt Lake City Olympic Committee. Now, of course, Republican presidential candidate.
Mitt's a great friend. We worked together very closely on the Olympics. We got to know each other very well. And his wife, Ann, lovely woman, dedicated herself to a lot of human rights causes, done a lot of work in the community with young people. I really admired both of them very much. And I must say that I am very surprised that somebody like Mitt Romney, who I always felt had such great integrity and was so reasonable, would have caved into his handlers and flip-flopped on so many issues that he used to say he felt so strongly about, things like choice. His coming out against stem cell research was just absolutely incredible to me.
What about his past record on choice, on stem cells?
Well, he was very clearly supportive of Roe versus Wade. He said that as he ran for governor, as he ran for senator in Massachusetts. He told me going into that race that Roe versus Wade is working. We need to get beyond this issue. And he felt that it was important that women have choice. So, but You can see very clearly what's happening. It's so transparent that a year before the presidential race, all of a sudden he's got these new positions on these issues. But then he's also said now that he was a lifetime hunter, having, I think, hunted once when he was a young boy, and then a little while back after practicing shooting a shotgun, I guess he went out with some Republican funders. That also is just absolutely untrue. He needs to be himself. If Mitt Romney would be himself, true to the people of this country, I think he'd be a great president. But he has fallen for these handlers and flip-flopped on these issues, and I think is misleading us in terms of his positions. But the thing that I find incredibly frightening is that Mitt Romney, and this just stunned me, that he could stand up and say, number one, that he would support this war, that he would have gone about this much like President Bush has, that he supports torture, and that he would double the size of Guantanamo. That, for me, is just so absolutely unconscionable. And I have tried to get him to meet with some retired generals and admirals. Human Rights First has been lining some of these people up to talk to the presidential candidates about what's happening, about what the heritage and history has been in the armed forces, how important it is, even for the safety of our own servicemen and women, to abide by the Geneva Conventions or their equivalent under international law, and also abide by our own domestic law in these areas. And to this point, he's refused to meet with them. And I do not understand that, and I think that it's so frightening that it's perceived by any presidential candidate that is going to help them get elected, standing up for torture, saying that this is a good thing for the first time in our nation's history as a matter of official policy.
Before he went through Salt Lake City on Saturday, Mitt Romney said on Friday when meeting with the Convention of Montana Republicans, "I believe Guantanamo plays an important role in protecting our nation from violent, heinous terrorists. Guantanamo is a symbol of our resolve." He went on to say, if he were elected, there will be a war waged on terrorists. He said terrorist suspects need to be kept at Guantanamo so they don't get safe harbor in the legal system. Terrorists, he said, don't get such constitutional rights.
You know, to talk about safe harbor, the reason that we've had upwards of 70% of those at Guantanamo who are innocent of any wrongdoing, and those are the latest findings. Look at the hundreds of people who have been released without any prosecution, any other legal action taken against them. A lot of these people were fingered by warlords. A lot of them were fingered because there were rewards available for people to identify terrorists or insurgents. They end up at Guantanamo, and then we find out that there was nothing to it, just like when we kidnapped citizens of Germany or Canada and sent them off to be tortured, and then found out months later, after torturing them, after holding them without their families knowing where they were, that there was no wrongdoing, and they were set loose. Maher Arar from Canada, El Masri from Germany, who was picked up in Macedonia, both of them shipped off to torture camps, and innocent. So how a president of the United States could say that there should be safe harbor from any legal protections, it is absolutely counter to our American traditions.
Do you think Mitt Romney is changing his mind on these issues?
Absolutely. This is not Mitt Romney. If you asked Mitt Romney, sat down and got the real Mitt Romney, first of all, he would say we never should have been in Iraq. Never would Mitt Romney and his wife, and they're a team, believe me, they would never support the concept of kidnapping and torturing human beings. They've always stood up for human rights, fundamental human rights. So this is an enormous clash of values. And I think that he's just trying to sound tough in the face of terror. And I guess that sells to the right-wing Christian coalition, as does his new found opposition to free choice, his opposition to stem cell research. This is not the Mitt Romney I knew, and it really saddens me.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mayor Rocky Anderson, for joining us, the mayor of Salt Lake City. He'll be speaking tonight at the New York Ethical Culture Society. As we end today's program by making a correction on Friday's show. On Thursday, we aired excerpts of a Senate hearing on the role of the White House Council on Environmental Quality in shaping the EPA's public response to questions about the air quality in New York after the collapse of the World Trade Center. After the show, James Connaughton, the chair of the White House Council on Environmental Quality, wrote to Democracy Now! Requesting a correction to our statement that he previously worked for the asbestos industry. We should have more accurately stated that Mr. Connaughton, while a partner at the law firm of Sidley Austin, represented corporate giants like General Electric and ASARCO in their battles with the government over cleanup of Superfund sites. ASARCO was forced into bankruptcy in 2005, claiming mounting asbestos litigation claims. Prior to his work on behalf of those corporations, Connaughton represented asbestos victims as a young lawyer in some cases against asbestos manufacturers. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharifa Bokadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Maté, Angelique Kamat, Jay Babalota, Jeffrey Hagerman, and Nicole Salazar. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Noguera are engineers. Also special thanks to Becca Staley, Hugh Grand, John Randolph, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Laura Chipley, Tori Townsend, Samantha Chambly, Carrie Mache. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org. Also thanks to Jillian O'Connor. Thanks for joining us.